Upright citizens are good for a city and make it prosper, but the talk of the wicked tears it apart. Godliness makes a nation great, but sin is a disgrace to any people. When people's lives please the Lord, even their enemies are at peace with them. Pride goes before destruction, and haughtiness before a fall. The king's heart is like a stream of water directed by the Lord. He guides it wherever he pleases. People may be right in their own eyes, but the Lord examines their heart. The Lord is more pleased when we do what is right and just than when we offer him sacrifices. The rich and poor have this in common. The Lord made them both. Just as the rich rule the poor, so the borrower is servant to the lender. Those who plant injustice will harvest disaster, and the reign of terror will come to an end. Blessed are those who are generous, because they feed the poor. The wicked run away when no one is chasing them, but the godly are as bold as lions. When there is moral rot within a nation, its government topples easily, but wise and knowledgeable leaders bring stability. A poor person who oppresses the poor is like a pounding rain that destroys the crops. To reject the law is to praise the wicked. To obey the law is to fight them. Evil people don't understand justice, but those who follow the Lord understand completely. When the godly are in authority, the people rejoice, but when the wicked are in power, they groan.
Now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. So these proverbs that you just heard are some of the most common ones that are often connected to our national identity. And they're some of the ones that are usually the ones selected to be coupled up with a political cause. So that's the ones that we put together today. And I put them together today because a number of you, we took in some feedback for what wisdom literature you wanted to explore, and political wisdom was one of the things that you chose. And I actually thought about today, the day where a game of football is being played, and I thought this is a perfect day to talk about America and how we read the Bible. So that's what we're going to do. Our year theme is wisdom literature. We're looking at wisdom. You see my title up there is American as Football. This is a very weird title for me. If you saw the image I put out on social media, it was a very weird image for me. I think it was perfect, by the way. I think it was ideal. So go give a look. But it was also very off-brand for me. But we're exploring wisdom literature. We're taking some cues from the church calendar this year. Right now, we're in ordinary time, so we're just looking at proverbs of various topics. And like I said, the topic today is engaging political differences with wisdom. By way of reminder, wisdom literature is not as simple as it feels when we read it today. And what I mean by that is when we read it today, we have forgotten how it works. We don't have a parallel to ancient wisdom literature in our time necessarily. Wisdom literature in ancient times in the Bible's time was meant to get you thinking, talking, imagining, and wrestling with things, which is, by the way, why today you are around tables. You're going to be invited today to talk to one another and report to the group at a certain point. So let your anxiety start to ramp up right now, just as you think about what that will be like. I think it's going to be amazing. I'm looking forward to it. A proverb might present a contradiction. We're going to see some of that today. Two things that feel incompatible, and those might be presented to you so that you will wrestle with the contradiction. That's the point. It's not trying to give you the end result of the wrestling. It's meant to actually instigate the wrestling. Many proverbs are parallelisms, which takes something like a simple or stark statement And then expands that statement with a following statement. So today, one of the ones that Peter just read is Proverbs 11:11. This is a parallelism. Upright citizens are good for a city and make it prosper. Okay, you might ask, how? What does that look like? What does the writer of the proverb want us to think about? What does it mean to be upright? Right? And then the second line says, but the talk of the wicked tears it apart. So the proverb is meant to make you think, okay, what is uprightness and talk? What's the connection between the two? Because sometimes we might think that talk isn't really the issue. It's just action. But here it says the upright, the contrast of the upright is the wicked and their talk. And so you're meant to wrestle with that. How does that work? Why is the talk so important? We discussed a definition of wisdom literature that came from Tim Keller's devotional that we recommended that you all could go through for the year. And in there, he talks about wisdom literature being hard candy, that if you try to ingest it quickly, one of two things will happen. You might crack a tooth if you just bite into it too quickly, or you would completely miss the point. If you just take a hard candy, pop it in your mouth, and swallow, you've not really experienced what the candy was for. And so wisdom literature, he says, is like that. It's meant to be experienced slowly by turning it over and over and considering all the layers that are held within it. So that brings us back to our text this evening. We want to take our time to turn them over and consider them, and we're going to do the round table version of that. But to begin, I want to give us kind of a tutorial on what might be a point of view that we bring to the Proverbs that we read this evening. And the illustration I'm going to use is football. Because guess what? People are playing a game right now. Did you know that? People are running around right now. They're running all over the place with a ball. And they're trying to get 6 points and then kick it for one more. Seven. It's a perfect number, right? They're doing that right now on TV. Okay, so here's what we're going to follow. The point of view that we come in with, unless you're, you know, Alex and Shannon or a couple other people who are just tasting the point of view, is we happen to be Americans. And that is a unique thing. It is unique. And we're going to talk about that for a second. And we're going to talk about that in football. And then we're going to talk about that and the Proverbs and see what we learn. Okay. What's unique about America? So many things. I'm here. That's one of them. You're here. That's another one. But the United States of America has the distinction of being the only major nation or world power that was designed and came to be during what we call the Enlightenment. So most of the nations that we would compare ourselves to actually existed either before or after this era, but we are the only major nation that came to be and was actually designed during this period of time. The Enlightenment, roughly, is an intellectual movement that you could say was really active between about 1650 and the 1800. There's, you know, of course, that's a very fuzzy timeline. Things like human reason became viewed as superior to the authority that came from tradition or even divine authority that many nations assumed, you know, through a lot of different divinities. In the Enlightenment, the individual becomes the chief arbiter of truth and morality, and things like individual rights, liberty, and the power of science to reveal truth, and the ideal of progress toward an ideal future become kind of assumptions that are built in to the society. If you grew up here, like me, if your roots are here, like myself, these things are so natural that they just feel like that they always have been and always will be. It's, I mean, I bring it into my preaching. The way I talk to you is shaped by this. It absolutely is. Other cultures, of course, have embraced many of those ideals, but it is unique that our country was founded on these ideals. And in that kind of system, religion exists, but it exists as something that you have the right to practice, as opposed to something that has authority over you. So you have the right to do it, but it does not exist as an authority over you. And it's viewed as best when it's confined to the realm of your private life. So it's because of individualism, it's best when you hold it privately and let other people do their own thing. So as I said, I'm leading us to examine some of these proverbs and consider how some of those principles might be coming to bear on our reading of them. But we're going to practice with the good old game of football. Isn't this an epic football image, by the way? I think I just typed epic football image and this came up and I was like, yes, Google. That is so good. Okay, anyway, football, as we experience it. Did you know, Americans, other people have a sport called football? Is this news to anybody? That we took a name that existed and we're like, no. We got a different sport for that name. Anyway, that's just a fact. That's a thing. Other people, we call it soccer. Everybody else, when you travel and you say, I play football, they're like, oh, great. You know, Man City. And you're like, no, Broncos. What are you talking about? You know? So there's another sport called football out there. But our football, American football, is a uniquely American creation, and its ascension is harmonious with American ideals. It was born in the American South. It's been tied to things like a conservative lifestyle, and it is uniquely ours. It was built here, in a way, for us. I haven't had a chance to read this book, but I'm taking a lot of cues from this guy, Chuck Klosterman, who wrote this book about football as a phenomena, okay, as an American phenomena. And there are a few things he brings up in his interviews. He talks about how in our lifetime, an ideal, and by our lifetime, I'm talking broadly, if we're alive in this room, this ideal is unique to our lifetime, is that it's ideal for us as Americans to create things that the rest of the world has never done before. That is something that we value highly, to do things that the rest of the world has never done before. And American football is an example of this. American football is powerful. Powerful. Why do I say that? Not just because the dudes are buff. It's not just because of that. In 2023, they did data, and I'm sure it's been done since, but this is one of the more recent ones. Top 100 watched television shows of the year. Okay? Take a wild guess. How many of them were football games? Top 100. How many of them were football games? Just guess. 25? 80. 15. 97 out of 100. Of the top 100 TV shows of 2023, 97 out of 100 were football games. That means it is very influential, right? Like, very influential. And the things that get carried along with it, the brands, the you know, advertising, everything that gets carried along with it gets a lot of influence. It's a powerhouse. It's influential. And it's especially been embraced because of its potential for this. So, Klosterman points out a couple of unique things. Football, of all sports, is best on TV. So, I've been to some football games. I went to one with Jeff and Renee recently. And it's fun. But you can't get that angle, right? Right there. You can't. It'd be very difficult. So Klosterman was talking about how even as the coach and the player on the sideline, you actually have one of the worst views of the game. Unless you get very lucky and something happens right in front of you. Generally, it's way across the field and you can't see it. It is uniquely built and good for TV. It's excelled on TV. It's grown because of media. It's also very difficult to participate in. If I said to you all, hey guys, hey mission, let's go play football. Right now, right? Think about the difficulties of that. First of all, we would have to play very modified football. We would immediately go into things we already know. Like, oh, do we have flags at this church for flag football? We don't. Okay, what are we going to have to do? We're going to have to play two-hand touch. Which ball do we use? Well, I don't know. We don't have one that shape right now. So we're going to have to throw something a different shape, and it will definitely not spiral. We have to modify the game greatly, because if I tackle one of you like a football player on TV, it's going to wreck your week, right? And mine. It really, frankly, it will be very, very rough. So it's a game that, to play this game, takes more people than baseball. Every single one of those people would have to know a very specific role. Like if I said to you, you know, you're cornerback, you'd be like, okay. Even if you watch football, you'd have to be like, I have to think a lot about what that does. Like, what do I do with that? In baseball, you go out there, you're the outfielder. What do I do? Get the ball, catch it, throw it back in. Okay, we can start to grasp that. But football, you have to know a lot. You have to have a lot of gear, and you have to have a lot of knowledge about how to not die, basically, right? Speaking of which, one of the big issues in football, as we know, is people are hurting their heads. And so here's one of the new, very large, you know, helmet apparatus that's being used to try to help people not hurt their heads. It does look really weird on the field. I actually watched a game with this particular dude, and it was like he kind of looked like a bobblehead, like a real-life bobblehead. But he's trying to not hurt his head anymore, right? And this is a thing. There's established scientific fact, right, that a lot of these folks playing football are getting brain damage and dementia. All sports come with injuries, but that particular amount of, you know, if you're a baseball player and you hurt your shoulder, you can't throw anymore, but you can still think and talk to your friends and remember their birthdays, right? This is rough, but we can't let go of it. Like, even if that's true, even if all these people are hurting their heads, even if it's really inaccessible to people who don't have a lot of money, like, we can't let go of it. Why? Well, there's a couple narratives out there. And one is that football is a powerful force for the kingdom of God and for good in the lives of young men. And that's absolutely a strong narrative. I've heard it many times. The other possibility is that it produces a lot of stinking money. Which one's the main one? Is there a main one? Which one's primary? I guess we have to look a little bit at which one's true. And I'm summing this up very quickly, I realize. So football on school campuses and movies and in the media is cast often as a core method of American character and faith development. I've heard this from coaches, people I love, who I like a lot. They'll say, this, you have no idea how powerful football is for developing these young men as team players and in their character and all these things, and how to deal with authority and stuff like that. And I don't doubt that that's very, very true. It's common to hear how many boys learn to be men via football and all of the good things that it brings. Also, there's an alarming number. Over 90% of football players publicly claim to be playing not only for God, but because of God. That's a high number. 90% of football players, if asked, will say, I'm playing this game for God, for the glory of Jesus Christ. The two quarterbacks in this year's big game have said it this week. They were asked, what's your primary motivation? And both quarterbacks said, Jesus Christ, primary motive for being on this field, Jesus Christ. And I don't know, but that's a big deal. 90% of football players say this, and you know, our two quarterbacks are saying it this week. I'm not questioning their faith, but Klosterman did some work and pointed out that the crime rate among pro football players is significantly higher than that of the general population. So the amount of Christianity, 90% higher than the population, so is the crime rate. Interesting, right? So if you're, you know, it seems like if you go pro, you're more likely to do two things: become a criminal and a Christian. So there's that. Also, you will make a ton of money. A ton of money. The owners will make a ton of money. The advertisers will make a ton of money. Everybody involved in the production and televising of this is going to make a lot of money. Which brings me to the halftime show. Have you noticed how often the halftime show is controversial? Like, have you heard this year that Bad Bunny is doing the halftime? Does anybody know that? Is anyone not aware that Bad Bunny is doing the halftime show? Most of you know, right? Why? Because it's controversial. Even some of the most famous halftime shows. This is the one of the most famous. Michael Jackson, We Are the World. Well, this was also a controversial halftime show. Here's an interesting fact. The NFL does not pay the performer of the halftime show. No money is exchanged to them at all, which is interesting. And they do that because they do not want to be attached and liable for what they do or say. It's not about how much the artist costs. They don't care about that. And artists will do the halftime show because it gets them a lot of notoriety. So they won't pay for it, but they do choose who it is. They do choose who it is. And they tend to choose acts that don't fit. Why would you do that? Why would you, if the general group of people that were going to get together and bash each other's heads together didn't want to hear about how, you know, all different races should be in harmony back when Michael Jackson did this, then why put it on the halftime show? Wouldn't you put what your people wanted? Well, it turns out that there's some strategy to this. If you're an advertiser and if you're trying to get as many people to watch your TV show and it's football, you know that a bunch of people, such as all of you fine people who prioritize going to church, actually don't give a rip about football. Or your team isn't there, so you don't give a rip about it now. Like Johnny, he's very faithfully here as a football fan, but a Bears fan who's like, bah, oh well, right? Next year though, next year, Johnny. And then we'll struggle with that together. So what do you do when a bunch of the people in your market don't care? Well, you offer them something very different. So the halftime show, the one that they select is the one that will bring the most viewers who are disinterested in the game into the broadcast. That's the goal. So, you know, Trinity Broadcasting Network has got Kid Rock on this year, which as a child who watched TBN as a kid, this is landing really strange with me. I'm just going to say, maybe Kid Rock loves our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ very much these days. But as a kid who grew up watching TBN, this is landing really weird with me. Anyway, I'm not even going to go down the whole rabbit hole. But this will not hurt the Super Bowl at all. Because what will happen here, and I was joking with Johnny about this, is everybody who, when the halftime show comes on, goes, yeah, time for me to go refill my bowl of chips, walks away from the Bad Bunny version, right? They go, I don't want to watch that. And then all the other people rush in and watch Bad Bunny, which is exactly what the people wanted to happen because it brings in more viewers. And then the football fan will return. Right? So if some of those football fans, instead of getting chips, go and watch the All-American show, it doesn't hurt football. Football is going to do very well. The NFL is going to do very well. The TV station is going to do very, very well. Okay? So I have a leaning, and I'm just going to admit it to you. I think a primary goal of football, I know this is, I think it might be money. Is that crazy? Okay, sorry. I shouldn't even have said it. It's a feeling I'm getting from some of the stuff I've thought about. And maybe making money is actually a really big goal, which makes us consider one final thing in American history, which is Sunday evening worship. So worldwide and very much in America, I know mission's weird because we meet on Sunday night. I experienced this within my lifetime, that many church traditions for generations gathered on Sunday morning for worship. Then they took a break in between. Maybe they went home for lunch or they brought some stuff out. And then they returned to worship again or to Christian education. The entire day belonged to the Lord. This was the common practice across our nation, and it descended from the nations that came here. They also used to do this too. Now, a trend happens to coincide with that changing. There's a couple trends. But one of the trends that began a little bit in the 20s and then with the ubiquity of the television in the 50s became more ingrained in the 70s. And then in 1987, ESPN declared something official: Sunday Night Football. Here's this year's image of it on NBC. Sunday Night Football. This has become assumed, right? The first football games were played on Sundays in the 20s. By the 50s, when the television was popular, they were avoiding Saturdays because it was a very clogged time slot, so they chose some Sunday slots. In the 70s, it became regular. In 87, it was just named Sunday Night Football. Guess what happens almost on that exact timetable? Church attendance on Sunday nights plummets. Okay. Correlation does not equal causation. There are other factors. But football is a big one. So I ask you, does the centrality of money-making in football, its supplanting of the Lord's Day education and worship, its claims to leading to godliness, which may not be substantiated, have those things been troubling you this week? Have any of you been worrying about the effect of that on our country? Have any of you, with the Super Bowl about to be broadcast, been just finding yourself weighed down by the godless consumerism of the thing? No. Did any of you think that maybe it's a potential tool of the Antichrist that was deceiving even potentially some of the elect of God who are out watching it right now? None of us care, right? None of us have been worried about it. Why? Because it's just football. It's just what we do around here. It's just a game. It's all over the place. Every Sunday night, there's a game. It's not a big deal. Right? I don't know. If all that stuff is true, maybe we should care a little bit. But my point here isn't to say whether or not you should care about football. My point is to say it feels so natural because football to us feels like the old chair in my grandpa's living room. Like it's just always been there. And will be there eternally because my uncle will not move it out. So I came to church to hear about football, right? Like in the middle of the big game, they're going to hit me with this deconstruction of my faith in football. Like, why are we doing this? And I'm glad you asked. Remember, that was practice. Could it be that when we engage with our Christian faith and the Proverbs, that we see it through such American eyes sometimes, just like we see our beloved homegrown sport of football, that either the way that we practice our faith just doesn't alarm us very much, it doesn't make us think, or we're in like kind of like with football, we're interpreting that like actually this way of viewing it is the best way. Like football's the best way to get my kid to be a Christian. Is it possible that we interpret our faith in a similar way? That's what I want us to consider. You know, the cultures who were reading these Proverbs didn't watch the Super Bowl. Did you know that originally? There was no Super Bowl. There was no TV. There was no media. Couple championships. Yeah. Yeah.
Before the Super Bowl.
Pre-Super Bowl stuff. Yeah. Very pre, right? Now, the Greco-Roman culture that Jesus had showed up within, right, was inching in our direction culturally, but they were far from our hyper-individualism. The Hebrew culture these Proverbs were written for was far different. I wish I could unpack all this, but far more of an honor-shame culture, far more communal. in which your impact on others and honoring the people that you were associated with was one of your top priorities. You could even say in a culture like that, that your meaning in life was to honor your community. Can you imagine thinking that way? It's different, right? Not to mention their view of God and spiritual reality and how interconnected it was with every single thing that you did. But that doesn't mean that their wisdom can have nothing to do with us. I was thinking about 1 Kings 10, where the queen of Sheba comes to Solomon, the great king who has prayed to God for wisdom. She comes from another culture, potentially Ethiopia or Arabia, and she's seeking answers which Solomon supplied. It's interesting that even there are traditions of the church in Ethiopia that claim the dynasty of King David actually was a part of their story because of her visit to Solomon. So if it's possible that the communities of the world could gather to that particular ancient faith and glean from its wisdom, so could we. So there's no reason we can't learn from the wisdom of the Bible, but we do need to acknowledge that we come to it with a certain amount of different views. I already mentioned that our society was born in the Enlightenment. It's also post-Reformation, which means many things. But one of those things is that we're schismatic people. I was doing a little learning. We're connected to a denomination that's connected to the old Dutch Reformed Church. And I learned one little piece of history this week in a class I'm taking. And that was that there was a great schism in the Netherlands. And some of those Dutch people decided it's time to go to America where we can do things the way that we feel called to do them, unlike these wackadoodles here in the Netherlands, right? And so they sailed over here and they'd heard there's a community of Dutch Reformed people in New Amsterdam, which is now New York. And so they showed up in New Amsterdam and they spent a little time talking to them. And then they were like, we will not be associated with you. Never. Why? Because they had a couple of little different views, which today we would consider very small. But there's just schism. People who were coming to our country post-Reformation were looking for freedom from state church. They were looking for freedom to exercise faith the way that they and their community wanted to. And a lot of communities were founded on doing it our way. And then those communities became diverse later. And then it got complicated. And then we planted Mission Church. Another thing was the ideal of the land of opportunity. And it's impossible to ignore this in our history. The drive to get here was a drive to get land and assets and positions. And to watch, you know, when you watch the development of our nation, if you read the history of the Southwest, what it's land, gold, silver, copper, right? It's like we've got to get these things. And for Americans, when we read the Bible, we often read language of blessing and favor through the lens of prosperity. Whether you're on the right or the left, it could be economic prosperity, it could be emotional prosperity. And if you think you're immune, think about this. How do you feel in relationship to God when you don't have enough money to do what you want to do? Just think about that. If your budget said no vacation this summer, if your budget said you don't get to buy new clothes, how would you feel in relationship to God? Right? That might mean that prosperity narrative is in you. Right? If you're like me, the two things that might make me go and pray are when I don't feel good physically, when my comfort's gone, or when I'm feeling insecure economically. So Americans don't just have a unique relationship to football. We have a unique relationship to Christianity. Okay? So what I'm going to do now that I've spit all that at you, is I am going to ask you around your table to look at these sheets. So the Proverbs that Peter read to us. I have one per sheet. There are 10 tables, and I think one is almost uninhabited there. So I have 9 sheets. So let's gather at all but one of the tables, leave one empty. Let's just call it that one back there, I guess. And these sheets have a proverb, and then they have a couple of things for you to consider, and then some questions for you to just dialogue around your table. Here's a disclaimer. I am recommending using Google and ChatGPT for this. Those aren't the best ways to read. I thought about dropping some research books on your table, but we don't have that much time. So you're going to have to realize, does Google and ChatGPT always give you the right answer? No, but let's just try it that way for the sake of doing a 5-minute exercise, okay? So you're going to get a proverb, a couple of prompts, and some questions. Around your table, you're going to get 5 minutes, and then I want one person at the table to write your reflections and answers to the question on the back of your paper in normal size font. None of this really tiny stuff, okay? Because you have 1 minute for one of your people to share what you learned or thought through. So when you report, you will read us your proverb, what your prompt and question was, and what your table came up with. And we want to believe, because this is how the proverbs work, is that hearing from one another can actually illuminate them more than just hearing from one human about it. Okay? Got it? You good? All right. Cruz, can you bring some pens out real quick? And then there will be a microphone. I'm going to hand these to tables. So circle up around all the tables except for that one. All right, folks, we're going to listen to table number one. If your recorder is collecting, please do so in silence. We're going to listen to table number one over here, which I don't remember what your proverb was. So you got to read us the proverb, the question, and your thoughts. Go.
Proverbs 16:18. Pride goes before destruction and haughtiness before a fall. And just the whole prompt?
Yeah.
Okay. This parallelism seems to bring together two very similar ideas. What is the difference in your minds between destruction and falling? Try looking up the Hebrew words for these using Google or ChatGPT and see how these definitions expand your thoughts. National pride in our country is generally something that is promoted. How could this proverb shape our view of love of country? Destruction implies a final, often violent end, whereas falling often implies a process, a transition, or a temporary state of loss that may allow for a rebuilding. We also discussed the concept of anti-hubris. The love of our country is a good thing. But the worship of our country is dangerous. The proverb invites us to practice humble patriotism, a love that is honest, self-aware, and committed to growth, rather than a pride that blinds and destroys.
All right. Thank you. Kyle, I think I've said this to you before, but you do have Baptist preacher voice. Yeah. Just if you ever want to switch careers, you've got an option. Okay. Table number two.
Is this on? Yeah. All right. Our proverb is Proverbs 16:7, which says, "When people's lives please the Lord, even their enemies are at peace with them." At first glance, this appears to be a health, wealth, and prosperity gospel. If you follow God's ways, then you will be at peace. But looking at experience, it seems like a contradiction and a false statement. Much of it, though, I think is dependent on the definition of peace. That's what we've come up with. The definition of peace, the word used here is shalom, which has a variety of definitions. But peace does not necessarily mean there's no dissension among people. Agreeing to disagree is a peace of a kind. And if nothing else, there can be peace between two people if at least they look at each other in the right way. If one person lives a life that is pleasing to the Lord, they're at peace with their enemy because they are not in conflict with them.
Thank you, Quest. Yeah, very good. Table number three, the only one that had images.
Hello. Do I need to read the whole thing?
Yeah, read the proverb and the prompts.
All right, 22:2. The rich and the poor have this in common. The Lord made them both. This is a fairly accepted truth in American Christianity, but it doesn't always get the same attention in our public discourse as other proverbs. A quick Google search will surface Proverbs 14:34 as being tied to an American political sentiment. Now I'm going to pause because it doesn't have that proverb in here. I'm going to read that right quick.
Good.
14:34, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a disgrace to any people. So we're comparing now that proverb to ours, which is the rich and poor have this in common. The Lord made them both. It says here, the second proverb is a church bulletin for sale for patriotic Sundays. When you Google 22:2, very few images exist and none have explicitly American themes. Why do you think Christians embrace 14:34 more than American Christians embrace 14:34 more than 22:2 as being proverbs that should be tied to our national identity? And there's some images on ours. We got the only one with images. We got Statue of Liberty, exalteth the nation, etc. So our response was, we said, well, because we're often focused as Christians, at least historically, on a prosperity gospel of Christian nationalism. So I think that 14:34 ties more into that. And then we also have the point that there's an expectation in 14:34 versus sort of a hope described in 22:2 for blessing as a country as we pursue our faith in God. That's it.
All right. I keep forgetting if I'm muted or not. Thank you. Very, very good. Next table, number four. Table number four. Oh, Cruz is... okay. Oh, Angie is table number four.
Proverbs 21:1-3. The king's heart is like a stream of water directed by the Lord. He guides it wherever he pleases. People may be right in their own eyes, but the Lord examines their heart. The Lord is more pleased when we do what is right and just than when we offer him sacrifices. Our question, what would change if... Well, the first one was, how does God direct a stream of water? And then we talked about how channels and water can be changed direction by bends and turns and circumstances. What would change in our public discourse as Christians if we committed ourselves to the wisdom of 21:3, the Lord is more pleased when we do what is right and just than when we offer him sacrifices? So we discussed why it's important in how we treat and discuss things how our nation would look different if we were more conscientious about our public conversations, and I think being gentler and less defensive and eager and like less eager to win the argument over, and not only just like wanting God to change the hearts of other people, but praying, Lord, seek me too. Like we should be, like it should be just in humility with conversing with one another.
All right. Thank you, table number four. Number five.
Yeah, Proverbs 11:11. Upright citizens are good for a city and make it prosper, but the talk of the wicked tears it apart. This is a parallelism, so the second line illuminates the first. What characteristics of communication exhibit the difference between the upright and the wicked? How have you seen the view of this in America shift in your lifetimes? And what other American commitment might be taking precedent? Well, some general things that we ran into, apart from the difficulties of Googling etymology and coming up with something useful.
Get to prosper. It,
Roland. Now, prosper is very much about building up, and tearing it apart is taking it down. That's nice and simple. Something that came up was building up pride, which sounds good, but when that's coupled with the need to be right and to be heard, that ends up being something that, while it sounds like it's building up, it ends up taking apart. And in quotes here, we've got hardship will either prosper you or tear you apart. And hey, that's something that we find with football teams as well. There we go.
All right, table number 6.
Is it
us? Yep.
Is this on?
Yes.
Andy, it's my favorite thing.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. Our verse was 14:34. Godliness makes a nation great, but sin is a disgrace to any people. We were asked to look at 4 words in the Hebrew. Godliness, great, sin, and disgrace. It said, discuss those definitions and share your initial reflections. And then the prompt was, how does the second line expand on the first? And how have you seen this view in America shift in our lifetimes? What other American commitment might be taking precedent? Well, we looked up all the words. That took a little while. But our takeaway, the biggest correlation was the word disgrace and shame, or busha. And that was like the main word that correlated to the word, you know, the phrase disgrace. I think that although the nation was founded on ideals related to the Bible and rationality, we've kind of gone away from that. The government's more a suggestion to a lot of people these days, and we've become very individualistic and worldly. So, that was kind of where we ended up.
Excellent. Thank you. Table number 7.
Is it working? Okay.
I'm going to blame this long sermon on you all. I just wanted to let you know. Yeah.
22.
Or we can jointly own it.
All right. Just as the rich rule the poor, so the borrower is servant to the lender. Those who plant injustice will harvest disaster, and their reign of terror will come to an end. Blessed are those who are generous, because they feed the poor. These 3 proverbs are in sequence for a reason. How do you think 8 through 9 expand upon the meaning of 7? We came up with, there is an order, it will be followed, and if broken, God restores the balance with grace, or through people via grace. The iniquities seemed to be named here are greed, pride, selfishness, power, and love of money. The responsibility to address those are God's through his people. So it's us and the generous. Why does this make an American Christian nervous? Well, there's a stigma behind religious people and Christianity. So a lot of people have made it look bad. So that's that.
Okay, thank you. Number 8.
Proverbs 28:1-5. The wicked run away when no one is chasing them, but the godly are as bold as lions. When there is moral rot within a nation, its government topples easily. But wise and knowledgeable leaders bring stability. A poor person who oppresses the poor is like a pounding rain that destroys the crops. To reject the law is to praise the wicked. To obey the law is to fight them. Evil people do not understand justice, but those who follow the Lord understand completely. The prompt is, this sequence of Proverbs addressing national life, our nation, government, law, leaders, are clues for this. Ranges far beyond our typical categories, leaving few American viewpoints unchallenged. Which statements here challenge the viewpoint held at your table the most, and how so? Using Google or ChatGPT, take it to the word for the following Lord. What did you learn about this key action that would lead us to understanding justice? Summed up, what we would say is, with an unclear sense of judgment, we mistake the author of injustice, the systems and the structures that affect us all equally.
Excellent, succinct response. All right, table number 9.
All right, so ours is 29:2, and it says, when the godly are in authority, the people rejoice,
But when the wicked are in power, they groan. The people here is a concept worth digging into. You don't really have time, but try to Google or in ChatGPT and look up the Hebrew translated for the people here and what it means. How can you imagine someone arguing with this proverb? And does what you learned about the people shape how you would explain the proverb to them? We asked a lot of hypothetical questions. But we will say the people in this means the nation, or could mean the nation. So we asked, what if the people or the nation don't agree with what is godly or evil? What if the quote-unquote godly are evil? And what does it mean to be godly? What does the people or the nation mean, especially within the modern context of things that are happening in our nation today? And do people rejoice over what is godly or what is evil?
Tables, very good work. And I hope what you've experienced very briefly, and I know that's quite the unfair amount of information to take in and try to synthesize in that amount of time. But I hope what you tried was wrestling with wisdom literature there, right? Like getting sometimes a parallelism, sometimes something that felt like it contradicted with something else. And just a couple of quick statements, reminders to wrap this up. I'm going to try to make it as succinct as I can because I do see the red clock in the back that I'm supposed to pay attention to. Remember, the basis for the book of Proverbs is the fear of the Lord. And one of the key ideas across Scripture is that the people of God are this nation that are responsible to God. And that idea gets expanded in like post-Abraham. You can become part of God's people by converting in. You can be circumcised. You can enter in from any nation. In Jesus, the doors of that are opened even wider to where all the nations are invited in. So the key people, and Paul would call it the Israel of God, are those who fear the Lord, who call upon his name. We might call that the church. And so the people that correspond most to the nation being talked about in the Proverbs are those of us who would say, I follow Jesus. I worship the God of the Scriptures. And then we, as a people, are scattered all throughout the world, and we live in all the nations of the earth. And so in every nation, including America, we have a role to be the presence of God's people, bearing witness to the kingdom of God. Also, we have a role to distinguish between what in our culture is of God and what in our culture challenges God as creator. And so there should never be any culture that goes uncritiqued, but there should also never be a culture that goes unappreciated and that doesn't get to where people don't look at it and say, there are wonderful gifts here and we are grateful for this nation that we have. One of our little exhibits today is this. As much as I said about football, we're going to put on a football game, okay, for the second half. And we're also going to allow you to play board games out at your tables, and we're going to eat delicious food. And all of those are cultural activities, all of which could lead to idolatry. Maybe it's not the football for you. Maybe if you're like me, the bigger issue, like idolatrous thing I might face today is the food. I run to food for comfort more than I run to football, personally. So everything that we engage with, we need to be able to look to it, look at it with a certain sense of there's the goodness of God in this. We can appreciate some of it, but everything we also ought to examine. And what wisdom literature and the Proverbs is teaching us is how to do just that. So keep wrestling with Proverbs. Perhaps you want to take some of those home and give them more time. Perhaps there's one that you've been curious about that you want to give more time to. But the core for us of Christian worship is the primacy of what we call the kingdom of God. And in that kingdom, King Jesus has come to us and offers us his blessings, his goodness, and his grace. So as Christians, we always begin any cultural engagement and any celebration with an acknowledgement of what kingdom we belong to first and foremost, which is why we partake in the Lord's Supper. And the Lord's Supper, we have King Jesus, who comes in amongst the cultures. Think about this. He represents God back to the ancient Hebrew people who wrote the Proverbs. He represents him to the Greco-Roman society that they have been like kind of, you know, brought into. He sends his disciples out to all the nations, but when he sits at the table with them, he becomes to them sacrificial. He becomes to them a servant. He isn't the one who hammers them on the head. He doesn't bring power through coercion. He comes to them as a servant. King Jesus sits at the table and he said, "Here's how you enter my kingdom. This is my body broken for you. Every time you eat of it, remember me." And when they thought of a broken body, they thought of two things. And when they thought of bread, they thought of God providing for them, giving them everything that they need. That speaks to the idea of what does it mean to be prosperous? What does it mean to be provided for? And then at the same time, when they thought of the breaking, they thought of a curse. They thought of death. They thought of things that seemed completely incompatible. And Jesus is saying to them, "I'm breaking to provide for you everything that you need," which calls into question, what is it that we need the most from a kingdom? Okay. Then he takes the wine from the table and said, "This is my blood poured out for the forgiveness of many," which the wine at a table could serve so many different purposes. It was something that could speak to judgment. It could speak to celebration. It could be interpreted so many ways. It could be the way that you got sloshed at a party, or a way that you drank to the glory of God and the goodness of God, thanking him for everything that he's made. And Jesus is saying to them, when you partake of this, when you remember me, I want you to remember that I'm a forgiving king, that I'm a suffering king, that I'm a king that offers himself for you. So as you go out into the world, we are to image forth the kingdom that we are primarily called to worship, okay? We're going to do three things. We're going to take a time of silent confession where we can, if anything has kind of pricked you or if you're wrestling with anything, that's a good time for some prayer. So there's going to be 2 minutes of silent confession. We're also going to come and receive the Lord's Supper and think of all the good things that the kingdom of God offers to us. And then we have our final idea, which is offer. We have a table in the back over here that has two primary pathways for offering. The first is offering financially, giving back unto God from what he's given to you. And the second is one of our favorite things we've added here at Mission, which is a symbolic way of saying, here's how I want to offer my life. So today, as we think about kind of our identity as Americans of what it means to wrestle with what God's kingdom calls us to, if there's a word or a thought you want to write on that window with one of the pens of how you'd like to offer yourself to God's kingdom, that's an opportunity to think that through and to kind of memorialize that for yourself. So I'm going to pray, leave us 2 minutes of silence, and then when Mike comes up and begins to lead music, you'll be welcome to line up here to receive the Lord's Supper. And then after that, we're going to watch dudes run around and blow whistles and throw a ball and play board games and eat. How's that sound? With me? All right, let's pray. Father, thank you for the chance to be with your people. It's good to hear their voices and to hear them wrestling around with these concepts at the table, thinking through what they mean for us. And I pray that we would be the type of people that live up to that old Hebrew name Israel, which is to wrestle with God, that we would continually listen to your word and struggle with it and ask you to challenge us where you need to challenge us, affirm us where you need to affirm us, and that we would be people who are shaped by your word and listening always. So as we come before you in confession, lead us into where we should start and how we should posture our hearts before you today. In Jesus' name.